comedy. It'll make you laugh even when it has a hard edge. Like a comic in Ukraine tracking incoming fire on an app.
Sometimes missiles are late, and Ukrainians become angry, like, where's this Russian missile?
Or an Australian looking to Van Gogh for manic inspiration.
I think he is the best artist because he had the most mental illnesses. So I'm really looking into how to get more. And
today on The World, an hour of global laughs.
From Chinese exiles telling jokes they could not tell at home.
We talk a lot of sensitive issue. Everything happens here stays here.
To an Indian comic trying out an American audience.
I'm not so Indian that I would study to be a doctor. But I'm Indian enough where I would never use a white doctor.
Comedians telling it like it is today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We have a special treat for you today, a show all about comedy. Some of our favorite stories from the archives about comedians and the relief we get from laughing, even during hard times.
Maybe especially during hard times. Our first two stories take us to New York City, home of many comedy clubs, and where increasingly comics from other countries are expanding their audiences. We begin with stand-up comic Veer Das. In India, he's a household name. Less here, so when he did a residency this fall at New York's Lincoln Center Theater, reporter Sushmita Pathak settled into the theater for his set.
As the lights dim, the crowd goes quiet.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Veer Das.
And then erupts in cheers. Veer Das has been a superstar in India for years. In 2023, he became the first Indian to win an international Emmy for his English language comedy. His latest Netflix special was filmed in Mumbai, London, and New York.
Okay, check it out. I'm not so Indian that I would study to be a doctor. No. But I'm Indian enough where I would never use a white doctor.
He is unapologetically Indian, and his jokes are rooted in India, but still draw global audiences. Like this couple, Gary Dundon and Sin Chi, who I met at the show in New York.
We've been fans of Veer Das for, a couple of years,
yeah.
I think, now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we try and catch him every time he's in New York. We drive in from Jersey, but, we really just enjoy his show because, I'm a first-gen immigrant, so what he talks about really resonates with me.
Das was raised in Nigeria, went to college in Galesburg, Illinois, and has worked in India as an actor and comedian. He's spoken about being a perpetual outsider. These experiences make global audiences connect with him.
I really like his Netflix specials where he talks to a different audience, but every segment still connects. He's very relatable.
Just to establish the format of the show, you will notice we have guests with us this evening in their very own special section. Just like at the airport. Welcome, non-Indians.
Das says he doesn't think too much about whether his comedy translates.
You want to come into a comedy show and be entirely surprised and come out knowing things that you didn't know before the comedy show. So I do think that there is relatable comedy, and that's great. But I think I prefer comedy that introduces you to new worlds.
And Das, he wants to introduce India, specifically present-day India, in a way that both appeals to Indians and doesn't go over the heads of non-Indians.
We have had a long time of our stories being told for us, or some version of us being put out that doesn't represent sort of modern, audacious India. So I take pride in being an Indian voice that goes out to the world.
For a long time, Indian comedy in the West was limited to stereotypes and exaggerated accents. Das's comedy, in contrast, feels refreshing, says fan Kanchan Barwani.
The whole typical brown comedy that usually, it really emphasizes our accents, our food, our aunties, uncles, our culture so much. He breaks out of that.
While Das's fame has grown globally, he's also run into trouble back home. Das did a monologue in 2021 called Two Indias, which offended many supporters of the ruling party.
I come from which India? I come from two Indias. I come from an India where we laugh so loudly in the comfort of our own homes that you can hear us through the walls, and yet I come from an India where we break down the walls of a comedy club because you can hear laughter inside. I come from an India... This is my voice. For better or for worse, this is my voice. And some people will be takers and some people will not be takers. But I can't alter this voice
Das's residency is part of an initiative to bring new artists and new audiences to Lincoln Center Theatre. Maria Manuela Goyanes is the artistic director.
I'm so excited to see this kind of South Asian community come to Lincoln Center and feel like they belong at this theatre. And also, the most exciting thing is to have that audience with the theater-going audience, the more traditional theater-going audience, and see that interplay happen.
The performance is a cross between stand-up and storytelling. He takes the audience on a journey and, above all, makes them laugh, just like he promises. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, New York City.
Veer Das came to the U.S. with a following. All across New York, though, there are newer comics testing their bravery at open mic nights. The World's Matthew Bell brought us the story of Chinese exiles in New York whose performances are part comedy, part group therapy.
It's not easy to get a ticket. As soon as a new date is announced, these open mic events sell out right away. And they're organized by a group called Nuzha Juyi.
If you translate it literally, it means feminism.
That's producer Vicky Wong, who worked on this story with me. Vicky is a Chinese-speaking stand-up comic herself. The audience is mostly women in their 20s and 30s from across the Chinese-speaking world, Hong Kong, Taiwan, mainland China. The theme of today's show is behind closed doors.
All the performers are sharing secrets that they're keeping for their family, in their family.
Liang Xiaowen is sharing a story about the time state security agents came to visit when she still lived in China. She said her parents worried the men were there to question her dad. But then her mom said to Liang, with some relief, "Oh, the security people are here for you." Liang tells me on Zoom it took a long time to get to the point where she could laugh about it.
Can you imagine, like, you were a closeted lesbian. Your dad called you saying that, like, the police were there talking about your activism work. So that scared the shit out of me.
She says she can't imagine sharing a story like this publicly back home in China, but the open mic provides an opportunity to do so.
We have a stage that's designed for us. By us, I mean Chinese-speaking women, queer, marginalized people who speak both, you know, Chinese and English, and who are still deeply connected with what's going on back home in China.
There are strict rules, as another organizer explains to me. She goes by the stage name 997.
No camera, no recording.
And why is that?
It's just because we talk a lot about, like, sensitive issue. That's why we ask, like, confidential, everything happens here stays here.
Another performer, who goes by the initials LP, says she has mixed feelings about not identifying herself.
It's a little bit sad for me to not using my real name, to be honest. But if, like, people connect your face and your name, there could be potential risk that they can find your family back in China.
The humor and commentary here gets a little salty at times, along with lots of jokes about the news, family, and relationships. And this is a reminder of what the Chinese open mic is all about. Wang Yaqiu is a fellow with the University of Chicago's Forum for Free Inquiry and Expression.
I'm a researcher for women's rights issue in China for over a decade. It is depressing. But I think this open mic, first of all, you know, it's comedy.
Similar Chinese language open mic events are happening in other U.S. cities, Washington and Los Angeles. Wang says they've been around for a few years and seem to be getting more popular. A new concern, she says, is the political atmosphere here in this country for visa holders and undocumented immigrants under the Trump administration.
Like, you wonder whether if I make a joke about Trump, would that affect my visa status? Would my visa be revoked?
But as one stand-up performer told me, if anyone knows how to handle a repressive political environment with courage and good humor, it's members of the feminist community from China. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, New York.
Punching up at people in power is risky. Comedy in some countries is dangerous. When Syria's longtime dictator was ousted a little over a year ago, comedians there started dipping their toes carefully into their new freedom. The World's Shireen Jafari reported this story in Damascus shortly after the old regime fell.
It's almost sunset, and a crowd is gathering at the Karma Cafe in central Damascus. Tonight, three comedians are doing stand-up in a free Syria. They're part of a group called Styria, a play on the words Syria and hysteria.
Because there is a hysterical situation in Syria, so we need hysterical laughter.
Members of Styria consider themselves as Syria's first stand-up comedy troupe. Sharif Homsi is one of the performers tonight. He founded the group 2 years ago. Homsi says he knew he was funny from a young age. Stand-up wasn't a thing in Syria, so he had to go elsewhere to learn the craft. He moved to Dubai in 2016 and took workshops by other Arab comedians. Starting Styria under Assad was a risky move, he says.
It was really scary because you're doing comedy in a dictatorship that are killing all type of art that is saying something.
Still, Homsi and his friends managed to not only start Styria, but also to push the boundaries.
Basically, we were smart about it. Politics, zero. We cannot say anything. Religion with stereotypes, you know, not too much deep. And sexual, we were smart about it, really smart.
At the cafe in Damascus, Homsi walks up to the mic and greets the crowd. Of course, jokes don't translate well, but later Homsi gives this explanation.
We asked for freedom for 14 years, but when we had that freedom, we didn't know what to do with it, you know. So it reminds me when the first time you have sex, you don't know what you want to do. Like, I want to kiss her, I want to hold her, So this is what we did with freedom, you know.
Syrians were so caught off guard with the quick departure of Assad, he says, that they're still figuring out what to do with this newfound freedom. Homsi makes fun of himself, too. He jokes about being frugal. His father makes it into some of his jokes. But the joke that gets the most raised eyebrows among the crowd is the one about the extremist past of the new leader, Ahmad al-Sharaa. Homsi says the red lines are still being drawn, and sometimes that can feel overwhelming.
We're still afraid now. The fear is in us, like we're sick, you know. Like, poof, regime fall, now we have a new one and we have new fears.
It's not just Homsi who's trying to make sense of this new chapter in Syria. Amar Daba has been doing stand-up comedy for the past 12 years, but always outside of Syria. He returned after the government fell.
It's very exciting, and at the same time, it's very confusing because I don't know their limits. It is our time as stand-up comedians to be the pioneers, to tell people that, yeah, you can talk about that. You can talk about that. You can say whatever you want, even in the streets.
There is one woman performer tonight, Mary Obeid, stage name Mimi. She says she still avoids talking about politics. Her jokes are more about herself and her personal life. Like, she used to be overweight, she says.
This was the biggest problem in my life. And I think every problem, when it's spoken loudly, it's no longer a problem. We can get used to it and make fun of it in a good way, in a comedy way.
And comedy can be healing, she says. After the show, a man who only gives his first name, Ibrahim, reflects on what he heard.
We need to communicate our fears, our taboos, in a healthy way. And this is the best way to discuss those really difficult issues.
The crowd starts to make its way outside. People line up to speak with the comedians. For Sharif Homsi, this is the power of comedy. It can start conversations that otherwise would not take place.
If they can laugh together, they can live together.
Syrians have been divided for so long, he says. It's time for that to end. For the world, I'm Shireen Jafari, Damascus, Syria.
We're taking time on this Christmas Eve to think about the serious business of comedy. Just ahead, a comic from Zimbabwe lights up the room with laughs.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
We
are all about comedy today, which is at its best when comedians hold up a mirror to ourselves. Case in point, Learn More Janasi, a comic from Zimbabwe. His observations about Americans are funny, but they also really stick with you. Carol Hills interviewed him on our show. Their conversation began with a clip from Janasi's stand-up routine.
When I first came to America, I saw something I didn't know existed. I saw poor white people. What? How is this possible? This white guy was like, can I have a dollar? I was like, I came here to ask you for a dollar. What?
Learn More Janasi moved to the U.S. in 2021. We caught up with Learn More in Pittsburgh, where he lives. Learn More, great to have you on the show.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Now, I want to get to your name first, Learn More. It's just like it sounds. It's your given name. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so my name is Learn More. It's because Zimbabweans, you know, we just give our kids names like this. It's a very Zimbabwean tradition. It's because Zimbabwe is a British colony. So back then, it was a great idea to give your child an English name. You know, but black people start going crazy with it and naming their kids names like learn more, give more, talk more, you know?
Now, talk to me about where you grew up. You're from a small village in Zimbabwe. What was it like?
I grew up in a small village. It's called Chimanimani. Most people, when I tell them that I come from a village, they expect me to talk about how bad my childhood was. But I had the most amazing childhood. Like, I had space. I had, you know, just the family that, you know, that loved me and just community. It was so beautiful.
So how did you discover stand-up comedy?
Well, it was this particular day when my grandfather was actually worried on where he's going to get some money to, you know, to feed us. So then he was worried, he was stressed, and then he turned on the TV and there was comedy on TV and he started laughing. And I just thought to myself, I want to be able to do that, you know, at a very young age. And I started mimicking that. That's when the dream started.
So who was that comedian at that point? Was it a Zimbabwean comedian?
No, there was no comedy in Zimbabwe at all. So it was Roy Atkinson. He used to do this character called Mr. Bean. You know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and that's why my comedy is so physical, because of that.
Huh. So what other comedians did you listen to once you got the bug that made you think, I really want to do that?
So I went straight into a rabbit hole where I was just searching for comedy and what, you know, the different forms of comedy. And then stand-up comedy, just fell in love with it as soon as I watched Richard Pryor and then Eddie Murphy. And then I watched Trevor Noah at some point. That's when I was like, an African can do it, so I can do it too, you know? So that's when I just started falling in love with stand-up comedy.
So how did you get your start? I mean, if there wasn't much stand-up comedy in Zimbabwe, how did you go about it?
Well, I just kind of like went on Facebook. Facebook was so new in my country at that time. And there was a comedy show that was happening at a local comedy club in the capital city of Zimbabwe, Harare. So I traveled from Chimanimani to Harare to try and do a 5-minute spot at that comedy club. And it was horrible. I got booed on stage. Like, a guy threw a chair on stage while I was performing. It was that bad.
Wow.
Because what was funny in my village was not funny in the capital city. So I had to learn just like that.
Aha. That's an early valuable lesson, isn't it?
Yeah, and I've kind of used it in my career because I come from Zimbabwe and then I moved to America. Again, what was funny in Zimbabwe was not funny in America. So I had to use the same principles I've learned when I moved to America. Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting because some of your jokes that you use in comedy clubs in the U.S., they play on the fact that you're an immigrant.
I'm sorry. Is it the air conditioning? Are you in a relationship?
No. Okay.
I got my green card now, so this time it's for love.
So, that's a classic. A lot of your comedy is very observational, you know, from the perspective of someone who's been influenced by American popular culture, but is now here in the U.S. to give us a reality check.
Listen, I've been learning a lot about American culture by watching American movies. And I've noticed every time when America makes a movie about Africa, it doesn't make sense to Africans. Yeah, I was watching The Lion King the other day. I was like, why do these lions have American accents? And they're like, in Africa? And here's the messed up part. The only animal they gave an accent was the monkey. What? Yeah, and it was Caribbean. What is this? What kind of Africa is this, you know? But I'll give them this though. The only accent that made sense to me as an African was Scar's accent, because he was British and he wanted land. I was like, ha ha! That sounds very familiar.
Now that clip was from one of your performances on America's Got Talent.
Yes.
And you made it to the finals of that show.
Yes.
What was that experience like?
Oh my God. That was such, even till today, I still can't believe I made it to the finals. It still feels like a dream because it opened so many doors.
Yes, and as I understand it, comedians don't usually do well on America's Got Talent.
Yeah, yes. It's so tough. It's such a tough competition for comedians because you're performing after like a spectacle, like a band with lights, you know, and just different musicians and just, you know, and then you go there with your jokes. So it's a different art form, you know.
I want to play another clip from your performance on America's Got Talent. It's a cultural comment on Americans and their dogs.
Okay. It's crazy. The other day I was just taking a walk, enjoying my day. Then I saw a dog in a stroller. Yeah, it was just chilling right there, enjoying its life. And the lady was like, so this is my dog. His name is Mozzarella. He's like a rescue, but I like to think he rescued me. Do you have a dog? I was like, yeah, I have a dog in Zimbabwe. What breed is it? I was like, I think mine is just brown. Yeah, I think that's the name of the breed, brown dog. And then she's like, can I see a photo? Can I see a photo of your dog? I don't have a photo of my dog. Because my dog is an employee. Yeah, it works for me. It hunts for us. It protects us, security. Do you think Simon Cowell has pictures of his employees on his phone?
And of course, that got a roar because Simon Cowell is one of the judges.
Yes, yeah.
I'm wondering if part of your goal as a Zimbabwean comedian here, observing Americans, is to get Americans to reflect back on themselves and on things they make take for granted.
It's not just Americans. It's the whole world, because the perception of the whole world on America is different with reality. So I think for me, I fit in between there to kind of like keep people in check and say, hey, no. It's like this here. Oh, hey, it's like this there. So, yeah, that's what I think.
That was Learn More Genasi with Carol Hills a year ago.
We're taking time on today's show to share some of our favorite stories about comedy and the seriously funny ways comics see the world around us. Coming up, why a comedy festival in Saudi Arabia was no laughing matter for a lot of stand-up comics. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Back in September, a high-profile comedy festival in Saudi Arabia stirred debate and accusations among comedians themselves. If you performed there, some comics argued, it meant you were part of the Saudi government's attempt to whitewash its notorious human rights abuses. Abdullah Al-Oda was also outraged. He's from Saudi Arabia and is now with the Middle East Democracy Center in Washington. He spoke with us at the time about the oppression that his own friends and family have experienced and why this comedy festival was a problem.
One major difference between these kind of festivals and the festivals where you see elsewhere is that this festival is completely sponsored by the Saudi government. It's part of their whitewashing machine that started since the Khashoggi murder.
Journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Yes. Journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was killed and dismembered at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And this is the irony here. The Saudi government did not take a joke from Khashoggi. The Saudi government did not take a joke from Turki al-Jasir, who was executed because he ran a cynical account on Twitter. And they did not take a joke from Abdurrahman al-Sadhan, who was sentenced to 20 years in prison because also he ran another parody account because he was making fun of the Saudi government. My own father, one of the charges against him in court was that mocking the government achievements. So this is a government that did not take any of these jokes. And now it seems like they are trying to promote this festival that for me itself is a joke. I think it's mind-blowing and ironic.
So obviously very personal for you, as you just suggested. I want to come back to your father's situation in a moment. Saudi Arabia has also hosted major sporting events and entertainment like concerts. Again, charges of whitewashing. Do you think these sorts of things, though, could help change Saudi society for the better?
Well, I think it's, of course, attended by a lot of people. People like sports. That's ordinary. That's normal. What's not ordinary or normal is that all of these events are completely and directly controlled, administered, and manipulated by the Saudi government and used, you know, to whitewash the crimes locally and internationally. I'll give you just a quick example about this. All of these actually sports events and many of these cultural events are controlled and owned by the public investment fund, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, that actually has a subsidiary called Prime Aviation, used in 2018 to fly the team that actually killed and dismembered our friend Jamal Khashoggi 7 years ago. This public investment fund is not just whitewashing the crimes, it's committing the crimes and then whitewashing it afterwards.
So, as you explained earlier, this is very personal for you. Your father, as you said, is in prison in Saudi Arabia, accused of, quote, inflaming society against the rulers and stirring up unrest. The UN has described your father as someone with respect for human rights within Islamic law. He's been in jail since 2017. He could face execution. What is the current situation for him?
Well, he's still in solitary confinement. He has been there for 8 years. This is torture according to international standards. They tortured him. They deprived him from sleep, from medication. They still mistreat him. And he lost half of his vision and half of his hearing because of the mistreatment and medical negligence. Now, 8 years later, we're still in the same situation.
How safe do you feel living in the U.S. and criticizing the Saudi government?
Well, I think I'm safe here. And to be honest, I have made my decision to not be preoccupied with fear, because that's what the Saudi government want to inflict on me. I think I will just serve their purposes if I stay silent, because that's what they wanted, is to intimidate me into silence.
I ask also partly because freedom of speech is at the very least being hotly debated in the U.S. right now, and at the worst, some say, under severe threat. Do you see a connection?
Absolutely. It's actually ironic and even contradictory to see that these comedians, who rightly so condemned the pulling out of the Kimmel show for a week as an attack on free speech, they are going to Saudi Arabia, one of the most repressive regimes on earth, promoted by the Saudi government, the very team that executed a record number of people in the history of the Arabian Peninsula, who commits so many crimes against so many people in Saudi Arabia, including my family and myself. And then they try to make, quote unquote, a safe joke that does not talk about things that the government of Saudi Arabia does not like.
Abdullah, how much of a comedy fan are you?
I like comedy a lot. I watch, to be honest, a lot of the people who went to Saudi Arabia. And to be honest, it's very sad and unfortunate to see the people that I like and I follow and I watch a lot of their clips go over there and talk to the person who tortured us and who executed people we know without even saying a word about any of these events or anything related to human rights.
Abdullah Al-Oda is the Senior Director on Countering Authoritarianism at the Middle East Democracy Center in Washington. We spoke in October.
Mental health is a serious matter, but for Australian comic Sam Kisajukian, his own bipolar disorder is also great fodder for jokes.
I love Vincent van Gogh. A lot of art historians believe that he had five different types of mental illnesses, and they also think that he was the greatest artist. And I think there's a correlation. I think he is the best artist because he had the most mental illnesses. So I'm really looking into how to get more. And
Kisajukian used to be a stand-up comedian. He is now a visual artist. A few years ago, he experienced a six-month burst of manic creativity, then later collapsed into depression. Kisajukian describes the whole thing in his one-man show, 300 Paintings. In it, he tells the story of a transformation in his life that began in 2021. When Kisajukian stopped by our Boston studio, he described what he was going through back then.
The pandemic was kind of ending as most people were coming back outside, and I was like, well, no, I'm going to go back inside. I kind of went counterculture.
Right. So you stop working as a comedian, you get evicted from your place, you crave this total isolation. And then, as you tell your audience, you find the perfect place to live for that.
It had everything I needed. It had no windows to disrupt my circadian rhythm or provide air. I had solitude. I had no neighbors. Sometimes at night I would practice. I'd go, help! And no one would come. And best of all, it used to be an old cake factory.
So you call it in the show your Willy Wonka cake factory, I think. And you say you barely left just to get supplies. You become obsessed with painting. How did you land on painting? Why did this become your obsession?
Well, I was unpacking some boxes and I found a beret, and I didn't own a beret, so I put it on. And when I saw myself in the mirror, I thought I looked like an artist. And then I thought, well, maybe I should become an artist. It made sense at the time because I think I was very tired of trying to express my ideas using words. And when I would perform on stage, I was trying to kind of show myself to people, but then it's kind of fit in this medium of comedy. So if you're not making people laugh, you're failing. And so it really kind of narrowed and crowbarred my ideas in there. And I just love this idea of being able to make stuff by myself, where almost like I could be the audience for the paintings and the paintings almost become a performer. And then I could switch hats and then I could be the audience. I could be the performer and the paintings could be the audience. And so it was like this dialogue with myself. So I kind of found a way to substitute an audience for just a painting.
So at the time, you, as we will talk about, had all this creative energy, but you didn't know exactly why.
I didn't know I had bipolar at the time. And what coincided with beginning to paint was a six-month manic episode. Manic episodes can usually go for a few days or a few weeks. I did 6 months, so that's how you get a show.
So you did get a show out of it, and it's very funny. How did you decide on the tone you wanted to strike when talking about your manic episode?
Well, I didn't want to glorify it or vilify it. I kind of wanted to superimpose, you know, both truths, the kind of full range of what it could be. I think a lot of people usually take one stance or the other, and I've kept comedy in there, and it feels different from being a stand-up comedian, because when I was a stand-up comedian, I just want to make people laugh, and that's the end goal. But in the show, I found that comedy is really good, almost like a Trojan horse, because, you know, people can enjoy it at a kind of comedic level. And if you keep people laughing, people that perhaps are not ready to have a conversation around mental health might shut down if there was no comedy. But I find that if I can keep the enjoyment in the room, then I can feed the more difficult ideas slowly under the table.
Did you worry at all that you were too far on the side of kind of romanticizing mania by talking about your extreme creativity during this period and making it all kind of a fun joke?
You know, it definitely was a concern. One of the big things that I did is I worked with a mental health organization to just do it like almost like a safety check on the show, because the last thing I would like to do is give people, encourage them to do something like that. Like I very specifically in the show, like, you know, I don't regret that it happened. I'm very glad that it happened, but I would never want to go back there. And I'm so grateful to have the stability I have now from post-treatment. And everything I do now is to try and stay in the middle. I think the thing that I try and do is explain how there are parts of ourselves that, you know, especially with people that go through manic episodes, they often hide this part of themselves because there's like a disconnect between where they are now in a stable state and this thing that they've tried to distance themselves from. And I think it's a valid part of your history. And so what I try and do in the show is say, you know, I'm not rejecting this part of my life. It was informative. I learned a lot. And I kind of want to show people, because that's a lot of the parts that I would usually hide.
So there's a moment when
this manic episode starts to turn into something else. Can you take us to that moment?
Yeah, I mean, at first it was incredibly creative. I was producing a lot of different kinds of things, and it was such a revelation to myself. I'd never experienced this part of my mind, it kind of exploding outwards. And but then it just kept going. And, you know, it did get to a point towards the end of the manic episode that, you know, I really was falling apart physically. You know, I hadn't been outside. I was malnourished and, you know, months of not sleeping properly. And so I did start to move into psychosis, and there was like hallucinations, and I started walking around in the dark so I could paint them. And yeah, I just got to a dangerous situation, and I had a fall and I hit my head. And it's very terrible that that had to happen, but it scared me so much in that moment. I really did think I was going to die. And I think that's what broke the delusion and kind of made me force myself to actually go into bed and just say, this has to stop. And I just tried to sleep and stay in the bed until the mania did start to subside. And then it was short-lived because then the depressive episode started.
So eventually you seek help. You're diagnosed with bipolar. You start medication and therapy. It is an adjustment. How is your art different now than it was before, or is it different?
I think the brain's fairly plastic. The medication did affect my short-term memory, and they said that it would slow the synapses firing in my brain. I think now I don't have the same like explosion of creativity, but what I do have is stability and consistency. And so the way that I paint is I'll do 1 to 2 paintings a day and try and document my mental state of that day. And then each painting is a reaction to the previous painting, kind of both emotionally and with color. And so because I'm able to kind of paint more consistently over the year, I actually am able to go much further with the creativity and kind of build something more cohesive over time, as opposed to like doing this big explosion that I end up self-sabotaging and tearing everything down. So I'm actually very grateful, and I think I've been able to go much further now.
Mm. You say that your goal now is to be more even, right?
Yeah.
Is there ever any part of you that is tempted to, you know, allow yourself to tip into mania, to tap into this seemingly inexhaustible creativity?
I think when I was in the first 18 months of recovery, you know, I do remember how well and quick I can function, how effortless it is. And I think I just got to this point where I was so grateful that I've always tried to understand my mind. And it took 36 years before realizing that, you know, bipolar was a missing link. And so I was very grateful to have that diagnosis. And, you know, I know I can't go back there. Like, it's too dangerous to myself and my family having to be on the other side. Like, I now know the amount of like worry and suffering that they cause being on the other side, not knowing how to interact. And so, you know, I just kind of disconnect from it. I know if I put my head down and I just do the work, everything is very much more boring now in terms of like what it involves. It's like eating well, sleeping well, being open about communication of when I'm kind of like, am I getting a little bit manic? Okay, reduce my workload, let people know, like figure out how to get back to the middle. And so I'm just very focused on always trying to get back to the middle.
Mm. How is it for you telling this story every night on stage? I'm wondering if it feels therapeutic or if it is a challenge.
You know, at first it was therapeutic. I was only going to ever do the show once. It came up where I got asked to do a show at a Sydney Fringe Festival, and then I had done it in previous years. I dropped out, and then they called me and said, you know, why are you dropping out? And I said, look, I haven't written any comedy. I did this for the last, this thing happened, and it was very intense, and I don't know how to make sense of it. And they said, why don't you just talk about that? So the night before the show, I still hadn't written anything, and so I thought, why don't I just put all the paintings on a projector and I'll talk people through what was happening at the time versus what I actually now know was happening post-diagnosis. And I only invited people that had to deal with me when I was manic and depressed to explain to them what happened. And so that part was very therapeutic. And then as I've started to do it, I've kind of was so confused that people would even relate to something that was so specific to me. Now when I do it, I think I don't think about it, about what its effect is. I just try and show up as stable as I can every night, because I don't think the show works if I'm kind of a poor representative of what I'm trying to speak about. So I think also the show keeps me in a stable state, which is nice.
What do you want people to know about life as a person with bipolar that we haven't talked about yet?
I think that, you know, society is not set up structurally for people with mental illness or bipolar. And I think that your whole life you've had to kind of like creatively problem solve to navigate society structures. And I think that when you move to a creative medium, your creative muscle is so honed over years that, you know, you can really flourish. And I think there's so much of us that we try and hide with bipolar because you can't make sense of it. There's a divide of yourself between these depressed states and manic states. And it is very hard sometimes to feel this kind of uniform history of yourself as like one person. And so I think the one thing it gives you is it makes you such a unique person in how you kind of, you've got these three lenses. You can look at the world through a depressed state or a manic state or a stable state, and you don't need to be in a manic state to have this creativity because you've had experience there. So if you just kind of like do it from a stable place, you can still channel the viewpoints empathetically of manic and depressed. And so now you have three lenses operated from a place of stability. And I think that makes it very, very powerful to make all types of creative works.
Sam Kisajuki, and thank you so much for your show and for talking to us here in studio. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Sam Kisajukian's one-man show and art exhibit is called 300 Paintings. We spoke while he was on tour this fall.
Comedy can be a refuge. Just ask Ukrainian comic Anton Timoshenko, who performed in bomb shelters in Kyiv after Russia's full-scale invasion. This spring, in a story by reporter Daniel Hoffman, we heard how Timoshenko uses comedy to make life in wartime relatable for people outside Ukraine.
One of the benefits of living near Russia is that you always live in a moment, you know? Always live in a moment, because we might have only a moment to live in Ukraine. People around the world try to find this way how to live in a moment. They try this mindfulness meditation, fly to Thailand or to Bali. Stop it, just come to Ukraine.
Timoshenko says that he and some of his comedian friends were among the first people to perform in Ukraine in any genre after the full-scale invasion. He says stand-up is an easy show to set up. You don't need much, just a comedian and a microphone.
This first shows after full-scale invasion were amazing. People laughed so hard because they have so much tension in their minds and body. And when they get this relief, it was amazing.
But as the war with Russia dragged on, figuring out wartime stand-up became tricky. In Ukraine, the war impacts everyone. However, there's a wide spectrum of how it's altered people's lives. Some people lost loved ones, some have been displaced, others are coping with trauma and fear.
Also, like soldiers, they have their own sense of humor. It's pretty darker, but you never know as a civilian guy, could you or not, you know, cross this line.
Another challenge that Timoshenko has taken on is performing for an international audience. He traveled to the U.S. and Europe as part of a fundraising tour for Ukraine.
My goal was to perform in front of Americans who don't know me at all and check, can I make them laugh? And it was a successful mission, not from the first performance, but in my last two shows, it was amazing. I was like, yes, I know how to do it.
In Ukraine, we have this schedule sharings. Like, we have an app, you can go to app and see information like Russian missiles are going from the Black Sea. Arrival time, 1 p.m. That's true. And sometimes these missiles are late, and Ukrainians become angry, like, where's this Russian missiles? I have some plans after shelling today, so come on.
Outside of Ukraine, Timoshenko says it takes longer for audiences to warm up to this type of dark humor.
People feel uncomfortable to laugh about your tragedy, and probably that's good. Like for the stand-up show, it's not good, but generally, like for mankind, it's okay that people will not laugh from your tragedy so hard in your face.
Timoshenko says he views his comedy as being part of a bigger mission. He says that raising money for Ukraine's armed forces motivates him, along with giving people a break from thinking about the war.
This is your defensive mechanism. When you start to joke about death, to not be afraid of this death so much, or you joke about your enemies, to get brave from somewhere. Like when you're joking about something, you're afraid less of death.
Tymoshenko says that in the future, he hopes to write jokes that have nothing to do with war, to experiment and be more creative with his stand-up. For now, though, he says his humor reflects the world around him, even if the jokes that come out are dark and uncomfortable. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
Some words are just funny. A single word can make you laugh. And we cannot do a whole comedy show without language reporter Patrick Cox breaking that down.
You may not find the word peanut especially funny, but what about this?
Kikiriki.
It's peanut in Serbian. And it sounds, well, funny. More than the English version, anyway. But why? Serbian-Canadian comedian Philip Jeremic thinks it's because of all those Ks.
It's very phonetic. It's K-I-K-I-R-I-K-I. Kikiriki.
Comedians have long believed that they get laughs from words rich in Ks. Neil Simon referenced it in his play, The Sunshine Boys. It's about the craft of comedy and was made into a 1975 movie with Walter Matthau and Richard Benjamin.
You know which words are funny and which words are not funny?
You told me 100 times, Uncle Willie. Listen, I have
which
to get to the
are
office.
Funny?
Words with a K in it are funny.
Pickle is funny, the Matthau character says. So is chicken and cupcake. But is it really just the K sound that we're responding to? Or is there a bit more to it? Chris Westbury heads a team of psycholinguists at the University of Alberta who've been trying to figure this out.
We were really the first people who seriously tried to predict what people were going to find funny and succeeded. And of course, we only succeeded because we were looking at the world's worst jokes.
Westbury's research didn't actually start with jokes, just an invented word, or a non-word, as he calls it.
Now, non-word was snunkupel.
With a non-word like that, in other words, one that has no meaning, you're reacting purely to the sound. And this particular sound, snunkupel, it makes people chuckle. Westbury discovered this while working on a study that had nothing to do with humor. His team was looking at aphasia, a form of brain damage that affects people's ability to process language. They asked participants to look at non-words among a sea of random letters on a screen. When snunkupel came up, everyone laughed.
All of the non-words were made up by computer. We didn't have anything to do with it, so we didn't choose that word because it was funny. But the interesting thing is we thought it was funny too, and most people do.
Westbury and his team decided to figure out why. They analyzed their computer-generated non-words and determined that when the letter combinations of the non-words were incongruous, they made people laugh.
The more incongruous it is, the weirder the word is, the funnier people find it, with some constraints. If you make a really stupid word that has like no vowels in it or something, people don't find it funny. But if you make a reasonable word that's made up of unusual letters and sounds, the more unusual the letters and sounds are, the funnier people find it.
The theory that incongruous non-words make you laugh works with real words too.
I just think the word gazebo doesn't feel English, and what it's used to describe is so specific and dumb.
This is Venezuelan-American comedian Joanna Hausman on one of her favorite funny words.
I think I've said gazebo maybe once in context, and it was at my like rich friend's house in Connecticut, because who else has a gazebo?
In this case, it's not just the sound that makes Hausman smile, but the gulf between the sound and its concrete meaning. Chris Westbury's research into what makes words funny is expanding. He confirms that K is indeed inherently funny, and he's finding more letter combinations that bring out the giggles.
Words that have certain phonemes in them are also funny, and it happens that both PLE words, words that end in PLE, in fact, any consonant LE, and words that have OO in them are judged funnier.
And what word includes PLE as well as OO and K? Snunkupel. Now, it just needs a definition. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
I got no definition. That is it for our Christmastime comedy special. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Merry Christmas, and try to get some laughs in.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
From PRX.